Thanks for tuning in to The Album Show. Formed in Sheffield, England, Def Leppard played their first professional engagement in July of 1978. The lineup then was Joe Elliott doing the singing, Rick Savage on bass, Rick Allen on drums, Stephen Clark, who's my guest tonight, on guitar, and Pete Willis on guitar, who was replaced by Phil Collin in 1983 during the recording of their Pyromania album, which went on to sell over 7 million copies in America alone. It took Def Leppard 4.5 years to complete their follow-up album, Hysteria, which is still in the top 10 albums in America, 18 months after its release. Def Leppard are the only act to ever sell over 7 million copies of consecutive albums and thoroughly deserve their reputation as one of music's most consistent hard rock recording acts. It was my pleasure to talk to founder member Stephen Clark, guitarist and songwriter with Def Leppard. Steve, how did the band get together? Were you school friends or workmates or what?
We just sort of fell together. It was really, really lucky. I met Pete Willis originally at a college in Sheffield. And I saw him reading this guitar book, and I was desperate to find a group. And I just said, "Do you play guitar?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Come down and play." And that's it. Just fell into each other like that. And we just sort of drifted together. It was really weird how it happened.
How about with Joe?
Well, I was the last member at that point to sort of join. And so they'd already established, they were called something different. I think Atomic Mass at the time or something. But there was Sav, Joe, and Pete Willis, and then I was the last to come in.
For a young group, you seem very savvy right from the start because you formed your own label, which is quite unusual for a young new band. Who thought of doing that?
Well, actually, I've got to give a credit to that to Joe because we really were serious about it from the start. We wanted to be a live band and to get a record contract. And everybody seemed to be sending sort of tapes to record companies and they all get thrown in the bin or whatever. So we said, if we make a record, a piece of plastic, we could go around to the local radio stations in England and sort of force them to play it rather than a tape. So he borrowed some money off his parents, Joe, and we got about 1,000 pressed up and went round all the pubs and everything and said, "Buy this." and luckily it worked, and it got charted in the BBC charts. And I think then all the record companies sort of said, "Wow, who's this band who've got into the charts? They haven't even got a record company." So it definitely worked, and then a lot of other groups did sort of follow the same trend after. Mm.
And that led to you getting signed for On Through the Night, did it?
Yeah, we had about 12 companies we wanted to sign us, and we did a really strange thing, but instead of going to London to try and get success, we avoided it. And we said, "Let the record companies come and see us." So they had to come to Yorkshire and see us in England, and we sort of made them angry about it rather than begging.
So how were the first two albums accepted in your home country? Because you're known for selling like millions of albums in America, but how did the English react to High and Dry and to On Through the Night?
On Through the Night, the first album, had a great reaction. Unfortunately, we got a bit of backlash for High and Dry because out of the groups that were coming up at the time, like Iron Maiden, Saxon and ourselves, and Girl, which was Phil's old group, we were the first to make the move to try and get success in America. And it was just a natural transition for us because we'd just been sort of playing clubs and things for about 3 or 4 years in England and there was nowhere left to play. It was like burnout. So we were first to go to America and they accepted us, and so we got the backlash for everybody. But it's all sort of self out now.
On The Album Show, I'm talking to Steve Clark, one of the guitar players with Def Leppard. When you play the old records, the two you made before Pyromania, like the sound is quite different, but the thing that sticks out is that you were very melodic songwriters. Like right from the very beginning, the songs were ones that you would listen to quite comfortably because they were particularly melodic. And one song I've always liked on High and Dry was Bringing On the Heartbreak, which segs into an instrumental piece that you wrote. Now, they're both very melodic, and the second part was written by you alone, the instrumental. Mm. Is this something that you've always tried to maintain within the group, something that the audience could latch onto fairly readily?
Yeah, when we sort of formed a group, we were very aware of, we wanted to have this sort of edge of an English rock group, but we wanted to combine it with sort of backing vocals, which was more American, but we thought if we could strike a balance, we could appeal to both markets. And there's definitely a direction we wanted to go in. And we always wanted to cover a lot of areas. We wanted the melody, as you say, but we wanted the edge. So we progressively tried to get more into that over the albums. Obviously, we couldn't do that from the start because we had to establish an identity. But I think we just built on that for every album since.
Mm. Again, that's been a trend with you. Each album has been a progression on the one before. But Pyromania was really an enormous step forward from either of the first two records. Was that because of Mutt Lange's involvement in producing the record in such a way that it had this great dynamic sound?
Yeah, I mean, we have to give a lot of credit to Mutt. I think we always had that sound, as we were talking earlier, that from day one we knew how we wanted to sound, but it was just finding somebody who could make us sound like we thought in our heads, you know. And he polished us and everything, and he made us really aware of different studio techniques, and multi-layering backing vocals, and encouraged us with melodies and things. And his input was vast. It opened the doors up for Hysteria, and that's what eventually now we're doing the music we always imagined to do, but it took time to create that.
How did you feel about Mutt getting heavily involved in the songwriting on Pyromania?
Well, that's something we always encouraged anyway, because there's a lot of producers around in the business who really get money for old rope. They sort of go out for long lunches and dinners. And with Mutt, he arranges our music, and we've always encouraged him to write, because that's, in our opinion, a producer's job is somebody that you employed because you respect their opinion, and to really polish your own ideas and to see it in a different way. It might push you in a different direction. If it's just a guitar solo, it makes you approach it in a different way that from the obvious it occurs to you. So he's very responsible for a lot of the music we created.
From their Pyromania album, that was Def Leppard and a song inspired by Marilyn Monroe called Photograph. And before that, from their second album, High and Dry, we heard Bring It On the Heartbreak, and an instrumental written and played lead guitar style by Stephen Clark called Switch 625. Those songs ran into each other. Now, in the second part of the interview tonight with Steve Clark, we'll talk about the frustrations that the band incurred in the making of their Hysteria album, which took 4.5 years to put together. They had a lot of upsets, including a terrible car accident to their drummer Rick Allen, and you'll hear Stephen talking about that particular event and how they finally got to make Hysteria, again with the help of Mutt Lange, a producer who's worked with people like Foreigner, AC/DC, The Cars, many, many other outstanding bands, and has really helped to shape the sound of one of rock's most successful bands in Def Leppard. On the album show, back to my guest tonight from Def Leppard, Steve Clark. Now, because of Mutt Lange's great contribution to Pyromania, how did you feel when he couldn't produce the initial session for Hysteria?
Well, we were very, very disappointed. But
Why couldn't he?
Well, after Pyromania, or when we were on tour, after the release of the album, he went on to do The Cars' last record. I think it was the last one he did. But Mutt had been in the studio for 15 years without a break. And with any group that he works with, whether it's just Def Leppard or The Cars or Foreigner, AC/DC, it's a seven-day sort of job. And you might go in the studio at 10 o'clock and not come out till 4 or 5 the next morning. And he was just burnt out, and he just wasn't in the right frame of mind to make another record. So in a way, we respect him for his honesty, because if somebody's not in the right frame of mind to create music, then it'd be wasting our time also.
So you chose Jim Steinman?
Yeah, that didn't work out too well. I won't say it was all Jim's fault, but it was just a mismarriage. It just wasn't the way he heard the record was not in any way that it didn't relate to how we made records with Mutt. So we just decided to part company. And then we tried to produce it ourselves, which was not slightly more fruitful, but a lot. Basically, because there were five people, and we're very democratic in the way we work, and we're very good friends. So we had to try every idea five different ways, because we had no headmaster as such. Mm-hmm. And so it was so time-consuming. That didn't work out again. So we wiped that album, and then by which time Mutt had a couple of years off and he felt ready to make music again, so Mutt came back into the project.
Just before Mutt did come back, and you're in the midst of getting nowhere or running around in circles, Rick Allen had his accident.
Yeah.
Did you feel like chucking it all in then?
No, not chucking it in, but it was the most depressing part of our lives for everybody concerned.
What did happen to him?
Well, it was New Year's Eve, and he was visiting his parents in Sheffield. And I don't know, it's very vague with the story. I don't think anybody really knows the truth up to date, but his car flipped over, overtaking, or somebody was overtaking him, and he hit the curb and it flipped over, and he went through the sunroof, and his left arm got caught in the seatbelt or something, and he lost his arm. And it couldn't have been a worse time for it to happen, but especially after 2 years of really getting nowhere fast. But we were really concerned at the time, not whether we were going to play drums ever again, but whether he was going to live, because he'd lost a lot of blood and it was a real lot of problems. So it's the worst time for any of us. Nobody even thought long term. It was just like, wow. And so we decided to get over it. The best thing we could do to stop thinking about it is just go straight back in the studio and just carry on working.
Was there any pressure from the record company or from people outside of the band to replace Rick with a session player just to get the record finished?
No, absolutely. Everybody concerned, including the record company and other musicians, they couldn't have been more supportive. And as we said, we were so concerned about his general health, not just his drumming, that everybody went out of the way and they were fantastic. But Phil and myself were the first to visit him in hospital after he sort of got weaned off the drugs and things, and when he was awake, so to speak. And we were expecting the worst. We thought, wow, how are we going to deal with this? And we walked into the room, and Phil said, what you done now, you stupid idiot, you know. And we all started giggling, and he was tapping his feet on the bedpost. He said, I think I found this new way to play drums. And we went, what? You know, we were expecting this guy to just be in bits, and he was really positive about it all. And so it never even occurred to us that whether we should replace him or not, because he just said, I've got this new way to play drums, and we were in the studio at the time, and he just... he'd be the first to tell us if he couldn't have done it, and would have suggested somebody else, but we said, well, look, you're in the band till you say you're not. It's up to you. And he overcome it, as everybody knows.
Steve Clark from Def Leppard is my guest tonight. So after the 4.5 years between Pyromania and Hysteria, when it was finally finished, could you be objective about it at all? And could you look at it and think, well, yeah, it has got a chance of even emulating part of the success of Pyromania?
Well, nobody knew what to think in the end. And when Mutt came in, which a long time before it was eventually completed, it was a breath of fresh air, because we'd heard it so many times in so many different arrangements of the same songs that nobody could be objective. And Mutt came in with fresh ears to hear it for the first time, and he really pointed us in the right direction. But it didn't really sink in. It was finished. It was like such a prison sentence making that record. You know, it almost got like a job clocking in and out. But when it came out, it charted. It went straight to number one in England. And I always thought that was our first number one. We all thought we'd be jumping around drinking champagne, and we were still in shock if we just went to bed. So we accomplished what we set out to. It was just a long-winded way of doing it.
Have you found that a lot of the fans that might have gone to the first concerts in Sheffield have stuck with you for the 10 years? Is there any way of knowing that?
No, I couldn't really be accurate. Obviously, there's a lot of fanatics that are still there, but we found that it's a slightly different audience now. I mean, a lot of the kids that came to see us on the Pyromania tour that were 14 were married with a couple of kids by the time we got this one out. So we just had a belief in the album that if, no matter what our audience was, that we wanted to have a cross appeal. There's no reason why an Elton John fan shouldn't like Def Leppard, or a Metallica fan shouldn't like Def Leppard. And that's the album we set out to make. And to cross sort of a lot of territories, because with heavy metal, or heavy rock, when you call it, there might be a potential audience in America of 2 million, and you can never get bigger than that. So we knew that to sell, it's got over 8 million in America now, that we had to sort of cross over to Michael Jackson fans. But it doesn't really matter if, you know, as long as a Metallica fan or Megadeth still like it, then it worked.
Did you realise that you're the only band to ever sell over 7 million copies of two albums in America? No one's ever done it before.
Yeah, we're the first one to do it. It was a fantastic feeling. We just feel very, very lucky that we were hopeful that we just regained the ground we lost. I mean, spending such a long time, but we never thought that it actually sold more than Pyromania, which was It's an amazing thing.
For someone who's sold that many records, you've certainly got your feet on the ground. Is coming from a place like Sheffield in the north where conditions were pretty tough one of the reasons that you've been able to maintain like a really sensible approach about your success, do you think?
I think to a certain extent that helped. We're all working class lads, so to speak, but I don't think you can rely on that excuse forever. I think making the album and coming from such an eye from the Pyromania success to such a low, whether we all had car accidents, that it really, everybody had to face up to reality. There was no fairy godmother going to bail us out, and it was, you know, we didn't know when we were heavily in debt, as they say, making this record, and we didn't know if it was going to sell. We wanted to make the best record, the ultimate rock record of life, if it's possible, but there was no guarantee it was going to sell. And so it made everybody come sort of face reality with a bump, and we just had to put a lot of hard work in. And we grew up a lot. It just made everybody like face up to things, because it was very sort of weird, because it made everybody grow up in a certain way, because people tend to get really depressed and upset about finicky little things, which we were guilty of at the time, like missing a flight, everybody gets upset or something. And it's a source of inspiration. You see this guy there with one arm and overcome it all. Think I've got problems. What about that guy? So everybody grew up a lot. And you just can't take anything for granted. And you're only as good as your last record. And the people that put you there, thank you. But that's the bottom line. Just because you sell a lot of records doesn't give you an excuse to be big-headed or blasé about anything.
I know you can't really plan too much ahead because things happen to interrupt the best laid plans, but I'm sure you wouldn't want to wait 4.5 years before the next record comes out.
We prepared much better this time around, because we were still relatively young after the Pyromania tour. We were about 23, and it didn't occur to any of us, even though we knew that we had to make another record, or what it entailed. It took us another 6 months just to write songs after the tour. So on the last world tour, we've been writing songs as we were going along. Any time we had a couple of hours, we got together, and we've got about 6 songs already finished now. And we actually got 2 on tape, so we learned from our mistakes. We're never going to do that again. We really want to break Australia, because it's the only market that on this tour didn't really take off straight away. But whatever it takes, that's what it is. We'll try and play next year.
That's great. Well, look, on behalf of all your fans in Australia, congratulations on just a wonderful album with Hysteria. And if you can make it back here to play next year, you make a lot of people very happy.
Oh, well, I'd love to. And thanks very much for your time.
Good on you, Steve. Thanks, mate. Def Leppard and a couple of tracks from Hysteria, Animal, and Pour Some Sugar on Me. And what a nice fellow Stephen Clark was. Like, if they've sold something like 20 million albums worldwide, he'd be probably a millionaire a couple of times over. He was telling me he's got an apartment in New York, because that's where most of the business is done for Def Leppard. Their record label is headquartered there, so he's got to be where the action is, I guess. But he also spends part of his time at his parents' home in Sheffield. And for someone who's quite a wealthy young man, he certainly has got his feet on the ground. He was very friendly to all the staff here at the radio station, and it was an absolute pleasure to be able to sit down and have a talk to him. I hope they do come back, Def Leppard, during this year to perform. They played here about 3 years ago at the venue, and there was a power blackout during their performance, and they actually played acoustically until the power came back on. That's the sort of band they are, that, you know, that there were no tantrums when the power got turned off. And it'd be great to talk to Stephen again, maybe, if he comes in, or even Joe Elliott, who's